Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Are race-based affirmative action admissions policies the best route to diversifying the range of Americans with university educations, or could we achieve that goal with less divisive and more effective policies? A number of high-profile institutions have reduced or eliminated race and ethnicity as factors in their admissions in recent years. Some observers worry this will mean a declining percentage of college-educated Americans of color. But my guest would argue those schools can actually do more to equalize opportunities if they extend special considerations to disadvantaged students based on where and how they live rather than on the color of their skin. Cheryl Cashin is professor of law at Georgetown University and author of the new book, Place Not Race, A New Vision of Opportunity in America. Cheryl, welcome to Think.
Thanks for having me, Chris.
You say at the outset that this book is about fairness. What makes life in America inherently unfair for so many people right now based on where they live?
Well, only 42% of all Americans of all colors currently live in a middle-class neighborhood, and that's down from 65% in 1970. If you are able to buy your way into what I call a gold standard neighborhood or town, and I suspect your listeners automatically have some neighborhood in mind that meets that idea, you automatically have access to highly selective K through 12 education that sets your children up very well to enter selective higher education. But the majority of Americans live outside those kinds of neighborhoods. And if you live in a low opportunity neighborhood, it is just much harder to access opportunity that sets you up to do well.
So how do existing systems reinforce those advantages and disadvantages for students depending on their socioeconomic background?
You're talking about systems in higher education right now?
Yeah.
Okay. Yes. Well, it starts with recruiting. Most elite higher education institutions, and I'm talking mainly about elite ones in the book because affirmative action doesn't matter very much at non-selective institutions. They get diversity automatically. But most elite institutions recruit in the neighborhoods that are already advantaged. They tend to go to the same 15 markets. In addition to people being segregated economically, we've had a dramatic increase in the segregation of the highly educated. And so places of higher education tend to go to these same places. And meanwhile, there's a valedictorian in every high school. Mm-hmm. There's a valedictorian and strivers in all places. So that's part of it with recruiting. But also with standardized test scores, in addition to over-relying on them as so-called merit, often elite institutions will only buy mailing lists for students who take the SAT. I'm from Alabama originally in the South. In the Midwest, the ACT is much more dominant. And so if the schools just buy the list of students who take the SAT, they will miss large swaths of high-achieving students in the heartland. So those are two ways in which place has a pernicious effect.
You use this really interesting term in the book, optical diversity. Explain what that is and why it's not a good indicator of a truly egalitarian learning environment.
Right. You can look out in a classroom, often in elite institutions, and see a variety of phenotypes, different skin colors. But if you go below the skin and look into the background of the students, often there's not that much difference in the backgrounds of the kids who are there. And I'm arguing that race is a blunt instrument. It doesn't determine by definition who is disadvantaged. And, you know, the irony for proponents of affirmative action, of race-based affirmative action, is that this optical diversity, without a lot, which doesn't bring you much difference in background, kind of lets universities off the hook. It inhibits them from attacking or mitigating the real structural barriers that create inequality, and and it also, race-based affirmative action also has the irony of it benefits. And I may get in trouble for saying this, but it tends to benefit the most advantaged people of color, and often those people of color are immigrants who don't come from disadvantaged backgrounds and, in fact, have parents who are better educated on average than all American subgroups. African immigrants, on average, are more educated. The parents are more educated or better educated than whites, American whites, blacks, Latinos, and Asians. So there's a lot of ironies here, and that's what I mean by optical diversity.
So the idea is that a school would sort of high-five itself for letting in the Obama girls who really have gone to the finest schools and have exceptionally educated, wealthy parents, that sort of thing.
Well, yeah, that's an extreme example, and I quote off the record, I mean, not for attribution, an admissions officer who tells me this. He said that he says it's more true than not among his colleagues that we want this optical diversity, but we really don't care where we get it from. My kids, pointing to me, my kids are quite advantaged, Obama's kids, the sons and daughters of, World Bank economists, it's much easier to admit kids like that. And I think those kids are perfectly capable of competing on their own. They don't need or intrinsically deserve a leg up in admissions simply because of the color of their skin. I say the same thing about legacy children of alumni. They don't need or deserve intrinsically special consideration just because their parents went to a school.
Are schools, particularly in the legacy situation, are they thinking about students who are the most likely to turn around and become benefactors in the future?
Well, yeah, I mean, that's what legacy preferences are about. The hope is that alumni will continue to give to the school. But increasingly, with legacy preferences in states that have bans on affirmative action or in institutions that have stopped considering race, schools have stopped using legacy preferences. The University of California system doesn't use them anymore. They also don't consider race. I believe Texas A&M has stopped using legacy preferences. So, my main argument is that in a increasingly global competition for selective higher education in the United States, no one is entitled to those seats. They don't belong to anyone. But I believe institutions of higher learning have an ethical obligation to pay attention to and mitigate the serious structural barriers that a lot of kids of all colors face.
I want to talk a little bit about the way that race-based affirmative action admissions programs were intended to work. Can you talk about what their early proponents expected to come of them?
You're talking about historically?
Yes.
Affirmative action 30 years ago at its birth?
Yeah.
Yeah. So in the 60s, when affirmative action came into being, it was the case that much exclusion in American society was based on race. And John Kennedy, President Kennedy, actually President Nixon also kind of had some role in creating this concept, the idea that institutions and government need to take affirmative measures to overcome racial discrimination. But when you fast forward 30 years, and I support affirmative action. I want to be clear to your listeners. I support affirmative action. I just want to make it better and fairer and enhance the possibilities of helping people who are actually disadvantaged. in American society today, to be a racial minority doesn't by definition mean you're disadvantaged, but to live in a low opportunity setting, by definition, you are disadvantaged. You could be the valedictorian of your high school, but if you're from a school with a large number of poor kids, by definition, I can guarantee that you're in a school with less resources, less experienced teachers. You may have zero AP classes, and you may be competing with students who are at schools that have 20 AP classes, and it's much harder, and you could be the hardest working kid who does everything right. It's much harder to gain the kinds of marks of distinctions that admissions officers look for. But meanwhile, there are lots of striving kids from low opportunity settings who are perfectly capable of doing the work.
How does it happen that poverty gets concentrated in the United States into particular neighborhoods or geographic regions?
Well, that was my first book. How can I say it succinctly? We had for decades in this country a series of public policy choices that tend to concentrate advantage and disadvantage. Zoning, in which you can lock out, if you are a fairly new community, you can, through your zoning, ensure that you have no low-income housing in your community. You can have no apartments at all. That's one example. A lot of our housing government-sponsored housing policies have the effect of concentrating public housing in communities that already have more than their fair share. There are a lot of public and private policies that tend to encourage investment in some places and discourage it elsewhere. And this, you know, phenomenon I talk about, the role of place increasingly is the mechanism by which resources are allocated and opportunities distributed. And when a place gets demarcated as low income, it tends to have a self-fulfilling prophecy. People who can flee that area do. Often investment flees it. And also, on the other end of the spectrum, when a place gets demarcated as desirable, market forces tend to encourage investment there and people going to live there, if you can afford to get there. So this is how we get so much differentiation across neighborhoods.
And essentially, it is the reality that people, wherever they come from, want to be in the best place they can, and the moment they can afford to do that, they go. Is that
right? And interestingly, economic segregation is rising fastest among African Americans and Latinos. Hmm. People of all colors want opportunity, and those that can afford to move to opportunity usually do. But then there are a lot of other people who are no less worthy. You know, we're all God's children, right? Tend to get stuck in place, and there's a lot less social mobility in this society.
My guest is Cheryl Cashin. She's professor of law at Georgetown University and author of the new book, Place Not Race, A New Vision of Opportunity in America. You can join the conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org, or you can send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree with concentrations in human rights, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Cheryl Cashin. She's professor of law at Georgetown University and author of the new book, Place Not Race, A New Vision of Opportunity in America. You can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372, or you can email think@kera.org. Cheryl, talk about this. There has been resistance, particularly among sort of white working class Americans in recent years, to the idea of race-based affirmative action, this sense that somehow they were missing out. And there are interesting studies of white working class Americans and black and Latino working class Americans of how they sort of view their prospects in America that might reflect the source of some of this tension. Can you talk about that?
Yes. A lot of white folks feel that the gains of the civil rights movement have come at their expense. And I'm making this assertion based on research I cite in the book from polling, social psychology research as well. And there's a lot of resentment about not getting ahead. Why I talk very frankly about this, and in some ways this resentment has risen since Obama got elected. But there's a lot of attitudes among whites where they feel like government is for everybody but me. I'm struggling, but government doesn't help me. Government helps other people, and affirmative action, race-conscious affirmative action, is a policy that the majority of whites do not support. I mean, it depends on the wording of the polling, but when asked about affirmative action in terms of access to higher education and whether or not race should be considered in admissions processes, the majority of whites say no. Meanwhile, the majority of African Americans say yes. So we have this very different perception about, one, whether inequality exists. Ironically, objectively, there is quite a bit of racial inequality, but whites in opinion polls say that discrimination against whites is a bigger problem today than discrimination against blacks. You know, so there's a huge differences in perceptions. And meanwhile, and this is part of the reason why I support using place and not race, because race-based affirmative action, you know, engenders resentment. There's a lot of mutuality in terms of the economic struggles of people of color and working and middle-class whites. Like I said, only 42% of Americans of all colors today live in a middle-class neighborhood. Poverty is growing fastest in the suburbs. There are a lot of whites who used to be, even college-educated whites, who are unemployed and struggling and encountering poverty for the first time. There's a lot of economic security insecurity. So I prefer strategies that promote diversity on campuses in a way that encourages rather than discourages cross-racial alliances. I hope that's responsive to your question.
Yes, yes. Mm-hmm. Well, a lot of people have questioned why certain groups of Americans, I mean, people vote on a variety of issues, and certainly economic interest is not the only one, but people mm-hmm. have looked at working class whites and said why, and questioned why more of them didn't vote for policies that would seem to favor their interests, and perhaps this issue, this sense that they are not going to benefit from advantages created to sort of increase social mobility can account for that.
Well, you know, I talk about this quite frankly. We have a long history, unfortunately, in this country of politicians stoking and exploiting racial resentment. And, you know, this has been going on for several decades. And, you know, this, if you're a progressive, this is what you have to face. There's that resentment out there that's exploited daily, not just by politicians, but also by radio talk show hosts, present company accepted. and that anger, you know, it's been documented in social psychology studies. It's very, very powerful. We have to confront this history, and I'm arguing that progressives need to be overt now at trying to seek racial reconciliation. I suggest by a language based on common harms. You know, with 5 decades of this, you know, kind of Southern strategy, race-coded politics, it will take a while to undo the damage, but I think progressives need to begin to try, and try explicitly, to get to a better discourse.
What are the advantages to institutions of higher learning of having a socioeconomically diverse student population?
Oh, my goodness. Well, think about it. In the context of any class discussion, there can be dramatically different perspectives on an issue depending on where one lives. And, you know, I tell the story about the head of Amherst Admissions, Tom Parker. Amherst happens to be a school where nearly a quarter of the students are Pell Grant recipients, meaning they're low income. Mm-hmm. And he talks about how, you know, because we're so economically segregated, a lot of kids from elite settings may not have any sense of what it's really like to be poor, you know. Going skiing is not an option, you know. Sometimes, you know, kids may run out of money and not be able to do things that high-income kids take for granted. Just, you know, being able to go out every Friday night to go drinking. You know, all of these kinds of things. And yet, you know, the elite institutions are the incubators of the leadership class, right? So it's very important for the leadership class, one, to come from all segments of society. I think, you know, low-income people and disadvantaged people have leadership skills, too, and they should be able to become leaders and not just have to get to watch leadership on television. But also, the leadership class, by being exposed to people whose lives are very different, will have a much better context and understanding for making decisions and not you know, the policies more realistically reflect the lives of ordinary people.
So for individuals who are preferenced based on where they have come from, what they have, because they are low income, whether they be Black, white, Latino, Asian, Native American, can we assume that those individuals will sort of turn around and reach a hand back to other members of their community? Or does the first generation kind of moving into a comfortable middle-class lifestyle afforded by a college education, does that generation simply need time to sort of adjust to that, and maybe its own children will be the ones to turn around and share those benefits?
Well, the only thing I have to base my answer on is the research I've read, and looking at the record of beneficiaries of affirmative action, they tend to be the students that come closest to meeting the professed missions of college in terms of giving back to community. Mm. Now, I think, you know, affirmative action shouldn't be based on race, but there are lessons there. I do think that a person who comes from a disadvantaged setting is going to remember that in their life. And that may reflect their choices. You know, I don't think they should have any heavier obligations than anybody else in terms of being other regarding and helping the others. But the record with affirmative action suggests that people who are disadvantaged tend to do that more than high income people who are insulated.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Sharon in Arlington. Hi, Sharon.
Hi, yes. My question relates to the state of Texas, and I know there are other universities that are making similar concerns, but they don't use necessarily race-based, but they use merit based upon your university, your high school, where you rank in your class. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to know if any consideration was given in the book. I haven't read the book. to how particularly UT, which has one of the issues with emissions based on merit, using the top 10, top 20, because there are even concerns with lawsuits that have been filed on that. So it's like whichever way we try to parse it to say we want to dismiss race, there's still to be this issue with, oh, well, yeah, well, I went to this high school, and it's better than this high school, but we try to move past the race, and this is one of the ways, and it seems to be kind of effective.
Sharon, thank you so much for the call. It is in Cheryl's book. So, Sharon, let's get an answer for you now.
You're talking about the Texas 10% plan, which I applaud, and that's one example of a place-based strategy. It's not the only thing I think universities should do, but that policy has been an enormous success in Texas. It has raised the college-going behavior of a lot of students. And, yes, it has been attacked by people who don't like the idea of less advantaged schools taking up some slots that used to be hoarded, frankly, by more advantaged places. But the thing that I think is wonderful and interesting about the Texas 10% plan is there's a constituency that supports it, a multiracial, bipartisan constituency, a coalition of white rural Republican representatives and black and Latino representatives. They have held together and protected that policy from being repealed for 10 years. And this is in a legislature that has a lot of disagreement about everything else. And that underscores my point that I think place-based strategies are more politically viable, and they can engender a multiracial coalition for fairness. And yes, it's been attacked, but the policy's been a success, and it's still here.
Yeah, one of the concerns that some people have is that students will choose to attend less rigorous high schools in order to finish in the top 10% and gain admission.
Well, I think there's a benefit to spreading around what I call college knowledge. I mean, you know, I think that's a salient benefit. If more high-income people choose to live in lower opportunity settings, you're going to get more economic integration. And all the research shows that low-income kids, disadvantaged kids, benefit from being around higher-income kids in enormous ways. And so I think that's a good thing. I don't think the gaming is so enormous that should be a concern.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next on the phone to Jerry in Dallas. Hi, Jerry.
Hello.
Hi.
So your discussion about place to me is very interesting. I'm part of a group bringing a certain unique college prep high school to Dallas called the Crystal Ray School. Has your guest heard of that type of school?
I've not heard of that particular school, sorry.
So it's a school started about 20 years ago in Chicago. There's now 28 of these schools around the country, with Dallas being the largest city without it. They serve only underserved students in the urban, basically generally urban centers, with a college prep rigor type environment. And usually the kids are 1 to 2 grades behind when they come. And they combine it with a corporate work study program. So the kids work an entry-level job in a white-collar environment, a law firm, an accounting firm, a business, one day a week. So 4 or 5 kids share one job. So they get exposed to, almost like you said, getting exposed to kids from different environments, getting exposed to people.
Interesting idea, Cheryl. And I suppose that sort of program could work for a lot of kids if it were available to a greater percentage of American school children.
Yeah, I think any program that gives some extra resources and attention and exposure to low-income kids is a good thing. I will say, though, that the charter school movement, which reflects similar strategies, although it's gained some traction, the record of charter schools is mixed in large part because charter schools tend to have high concentrations of low-income kids. And it's very, very hard to educate children well in the context of high poverty. And that's why I've been an advocate for a long time of economic integration in K through 12 education. I mean, it's the same kind of thing that my PLACE strategy hopes to achieve for higher education.
How do you encourage that economic integration when there are some, you know, public schools, even in this part of Texas, that are schools full of poor children surrounded by rather wealthy neighborhoods that choose not to send their children to those same schools?
Well, one of the best examples that I tout in the book is the Hartford, Connecticut area. As a result of a lawsuit called the Chef case, Chef v. O'Neill, and a multiracial coalition of parents that grew up around the Chef case, that city and surrounding suburbs have built something like 45 magnet schools. Magnet schools which enable low-income minority kids who are in high-poverty areas to attend a well-resourced school that's not in their neighborhood, decoupled from their ability to move into a neighborhood like that. But it's also attracted white kids, suburban kids, and the lesson from the Chef movement is that if states and cities build high-quality magnet schools that allow children from all circumstances to come with great programs, parents will come, and the willing, privileged kids can access resources for free without having to pay for fancy private schools, and low-income kids can also access quality. So that's the strategy that I think is most successful in creating economic integration despite segregated neighborhoods.
We're talking to Georgetown University Law Professor Cheryl Cashin. Her book is Place Not Race, A New Vision of Opportunity in America. We'll be back in 2 minutes.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree with concentrations in human rights, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Cheryl Cashin. She's professor of law at Georgetown University and author of the new book, Place Not Race, A New Vision of Opportunity in America. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Cheryl, you've written about the fact that toward the end of his life, Dr. Martin Luther King was looking to expand the scope of the civil rights movement to address issues of poverty, certainly among African Americans, but really among Americans of all races. How did that aspect of the civil rights movement get largely overlooked in the years following King's assassination?
Well, I think because activists in the movement had been so focused on dismantling Jim Crow, which was a race-based strategy, a race-based policy, and then trying to overcome the long legacy of Jim Crow, focusing on race, this idea of the mutual human struggle in this country got lost. And I spent a lot of time reading King's writings as I was writing this book, and his writings were grounded in universal Christian love. And I'll say I'm a Christian, and I really think that's right. That I mean, not to say that, you know, there the other religions aren't worthy, but I think this idea of, you know, needing to understand that a lot of people of all colors suffer. And, I mean, what King said is move beyond our own tribe. And he had this vision of creating, he called them middle class utopias, where people of all colors could gather and government could be a force for good to make people's lives better and to build the beloved community. And that's why I think, you know, we need a new 21st century discourse, a new civil rights discourse that's grounded in fairness rather than race.
Is there pushback today from members of racial and ethnic minority communities to this idea of taking away race and ethnicity-based preferences in affirmative action and in university admissions?
Well, yeah, you know, I've received some pushback, but I've also been heartened. You know, even my friends in the civil rights community that support race-based affirmative action have been quite civil, and they've been open-minded. They've tended to say things, well, why not both and? You know, mm-hmm. Why don't we do both? Why don't we take consideration of place and still consider race? And I'm arguing that, you know, we're so stuck. Our politics feel broken to me. And I think we have to, if you want something truly transformative, and by the way, you know, affirmative action is important, but not nearly as important as investing well in K-12 education, you know. And if you want to have a saner politics that, and I don't care what your issue is, whether it's climate change or de-incarceration or investing in K-12 education or, frankly, just building bridges and roads and infrastructure, these gaps of perception, this sort of toxic racial division in our politics, you're going to bump up against that. And so that's why I think we need a discourse that's not doesn't lead with race. And I'm not saying race doesn't matter, but that's why I suggest place when it comes to affirmative action and some other strategies. If you can, as several of the universities who operate under bans, get very, very close to the same numbers in terms of racial diversity on your campus without using race, then why not? And meanwhile, let's attack the systemic things that are unfair. I argue that SAT scores should be optional, that financial aid should return to be being based on need, not merit, that the admissions process should be blown up and focused on the factors that truly predict success, like cumulative high school GPA and grit, the willingness to do it, and let's build a coalition for fair access to college and fair opportunity in other settings.
Let's go back to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. We have Paul on the line in Dallas. Hi, Paul.
Yes, I understand your, altruistic views, but the reality says the elephant in the room is still race. Blacks are only 13% of the population. And if we hit other races, you're coming up with about, 45? Well, a lot of these people are still disenfranchised. And it's wonderful to look at this whole thing from an altruistic point of view, but the reality says that the society is doing something completely different. And we cannot buy the race issue. We cannot, because it is the elephant in the room. And until everyone changes their outlook on the race situation, it's going to remain the same. People are racist in their own way. That's my comment.
Thanks for your call. What do you think, Cheryl?
Well, I don't deny that race is there. I don't deny that. In the final chapter of my book, Reconciliation, I hold up examples of multiracial coalitions that included whites, blacks, Latinos, and some Republicans to move a public policy discussion to a fair direction. And I'm not saying we shouldn't discuss race, but I am saying we have to be more complicated and nuanced about how we approach this. I mean, how the caller thinks we will get to a place where policies, where the government doesn't over-incarcerate young black males, for example, or, you know, doesn't, where we engage in less racial profiling, where we address structural disadvantages that lock a lot of disadvantaged black kids out. I'm an advocate for all of that. I encourage the caller to read the book and see what he thinks. I'm not saying we shouldn't that race is no longer salient. I'm just saying we need to be more careful about how we get to 55% and have a strong coalition for fairness.
Do you think that a greater percentage of American students of color would actually benefit if we moved to a system that preferenced people based on place rather than race?
Yes. And that's the other thing, right? Why are we expending so much energy for a race-based affirmative action? And by the way, only a third of public universities still use race in admissions and less than half of private universities. And this policy is under assault. It's under assault in the courts. There's organizations that are out there trying to find the next Abigail Fisher. You know, why are we expending all this energy to try to fight to save this dying policy when there are other strategies for a policy that doesn't really help the vast numbers of black and Latino kids who are disadvantaged? For me, you know, that's where my heart is. I think the recommendations I have made will give much more access and opportunity to strivers of color from disadvantaged settings than a place-based policy that tends to benefit highly advantaged black people, many of whom aren't originally from the United States.
Earlier, you touched on the importance of really robust investment in improving K through 12 education, particularly for low-income students, because so many of those students' problems are wrapped up not in the fact that they have bad teachers or that their schools are inadequate, but because they simply bring poverty issues to school with them. Are we focusing, sometimes are we putting too much emphasis on the schools and not enough on the communities that surround them?
Well, I mean, affirmative action does nothing to deal with the underlying issues of concentrated poverty.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, I wrote about it because the Supreme Court—it's been in the Supreme Court of late—and but that's part of the irony for me. Like, why are we spending all this energy on this when what we really need is a saner politics in which, you know, we can invest wisely in all communities and pursue policies that might deconcentrate poverty, you know, build constituencies for fairness and for integration. That's part of the point.
Let's go back to the phones now. We have Steve on the line in Carrollton. Hi, Steve.
Hi.
Oh, I'm sorry, you're breaking up. We will hopefully get Steve back on the line and we'll talk to him in a minute. My guest is Cheryl Cashin. Her new book is called Place Not Race, A New Vision of Opportunity in America. How responsive do you find people who think that merit scholarships are a good thing and will draw the best students? I mean, this is another thing that you sort of take down in the book that is a kind of a longstanding tradition in American universities.
Well, in the dinosaur age when I went off to college, financial aid was based on need, and they had, you know, relatively few merit scholarships, but there wasn't even this word merit aid. But now, the lowest income, there's a limited pot of money of financial aid dollars, and there's a bidding game that goes on for the most advantage of people who need financial aid. And all of this is driven by U.S. World and News Report, U.S. News and World Report. And we're losing sight of the point of financial aid is to help people who have financial need. And the lowest income students who are frankly, a very low-income student is not likely to score extremely high on the SAT. Why? Because the main predictor of success on the SAT is the income of the parents. You know, the higher income you are, your parents are, the higher you score on the SAT. So we have this perverse thing going on where we, first of all, we call an SAT score merit, which is highly dubious. All the research I cite shows it doesn't really predict much at all about the success of a student in college as compared to the cumulative high school GPA. And then, you know, your SAT score has a lot to do with whether you have merit, and then it disadvantages you in the competition for scarce financial aid dollars. So, you know, if you look back to, you know, what the federal statute says about what financial aid is for, it's to help people based on financial need. We should just leave it at that.
Can you talk, I want to finish up with this idea, top 10% programs like the one that we have working in Texas. The students who arrive there, whether they be from the sort of elite public schools in which kids have finished 10% or the ones with more concentrated poverty, do they tend to achieve at similar rates once they get to those campuses?
Well, I haven't read definitive data about how kids are doing, step back. Actually, the research that I have read speaks well of 10%ers.
Mm-hmm.
I call them 10%ers because they're top 10% of the class. On average, they're doing well. That's not to say that some of them don't struggle. You may have seen this recent New York Times magazine piece about the plan and some of the kids at UT who struggle. But the happy story there is that with modest, almost no-cost interventions that help kids feel like they're entitled to be there, and they are if they're in the top 10%, that they can dramatically improve their success rates. But on average, the GPAs of the top 10%ers, that people who score high in high school with high GPAs tend to repeat that performance. But that doesn't mean, I want to be honest, it doesn't mean that kids who come from poor resource schools may not struggle. But everything I've read suggests that struggle is surmountable if the institution pays attention to that kid's needs and makes sure that they're supported.
Cheryl Cashin is professor of law at Georgetown University and author of the new book, Place Not Race, A New Vision of Opportunity in America. Cheryl, it's been a really fascinating discussion. Thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think, and you can contact the show via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.